You're listening to the Sportsman's Empire Podcast Network, and this episode is brought to you by Interstate Batteries. For all of your battery needs, visit your local Interstate Batteries retail store. Interstate Batteries, outrageously dependable. Since 1988, Whitetail Institute has been perfecting annual and perennial seed products specifically for hunters who plant food plots. Their seeds have been engineered to be palatable, high in protein, and extremely attractive to deer. Whether you live in the Deep South or Midwest farm country, they have products that will help you grow your best food plot yet. For more information about their seeds and their blends, visit whitetailinstitute.com. Enter the discount code SE15 for 15% off.
Okay.
Ladies and gentlemen.
Here we go.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to another episode of the How to Hunt Deer podcast. I'm your host, Dan Johnson, and my other host over here, what do we say? 300 miles, roughly, you think?
Yeah, it's like 3 hours, three and a half hours.
3 hours. Yeah. My other co-host, my host, my other deer slaying partner over here, Jason. Jason, good weekend, bud.
Yeah, we had a pretty good weekend. We did a lot of stuff. It was relaxing, but it was also a Saturday morning. I ran a 5K in an actual race, which was the first race I've run probably since last fall. So that was good to get out and stretch the legs. Fun course, different one I haven't run before. I got all my regular trail cameras out. Put new batteries in them, formatted cards. I do not have them in the woods yet, but at least have them ready, you know, and they're going to be, I'm going to put them in the truck. And if I have a chance, I'll swing by. Shot my bow last night, really getting dialed in with that. So that was good. We had a 25th wedding anniversary that we went to yesterday. And then we had the end of the year baseball, wiffle ball celebration for my son's team. So we all did that. I'm trying to think what else we did, man. We packed a lot in, you know, it was just a busy weekend.
Yeah. We did the same, dude. And when I say busy weekend, I say it was busy for me and my wife. The kids were just like, I don't know where I'm from. We live on a street with a ton of kids. And I mean like 25, 30 kids.
Oh, wow.
And so it's just like a wave of kids will come by the house and then a wave of kids will go down the street and you can hear them yelling throughout the neighborhood. So as I'm sitting there, you know, we got new siding on our house. We got some new windows put in, and I went ahead and I tore out a retaining wall. I tore out all the mulch in this flower bed. I pulled all these old plants out, and then I replanted. I put that black landscaping paper down.
Yeah.
Then I did some planting, and then I did that I rebuilt the retaining wall. Then I put the rock in, and I still have to do that to two other sides of the house. And then that was Saturday. So here's what happened Saturday afternoon. I'm sitting down and I'm relaxing after I just busted my ass all day. And I see some water on my garage floor. And I'm like, what the hell does this come from? Is this the air conditioning for my wife's car? Maybe, you know, you see some of those drips sometimes.
Uh-huh.
Well, somebody, every kid I talked to denied it. They went in for a popsicle in my deep freeze.
Oh.
And it must have been the day before or something like that. Because it had been open enough to where the meat was cold, but completely thawed out. So I'm talking, man, 20 packs of bratwursts.
Oh, my gosh.
Probably 5 ring salami, all deer meat, 4 packs of ground deer. I threw away all of the meat that was in the door because it was warm.
Right.
And that would have been like all my beef. My ground beef, I had some steaks in there. They were all warm, so those went right into the trash. So I got on my golf cart and I literally drove around town handing out deer meat to people, basically being like, "Dude, eat this in the next 5 to 7 days."
Oh my!
And gosh. So I bet you I lost 30 pounds 30 pounds, maybe more of deer meat.
Yeah.
This okay. weekend.
So I'll let you finish your story, but you hit on a couple things, and then I want to talk about this meat thing. So there's got to be, I mean, that's like gut wrenching, right?
Yeah, it pisses me off.
Right.
Like a lot. Yeah.
Yeah. So a few years ago, I lost a similar freezer. It actually just went bad. It was an old one, you know. But I mean, yep. when you think about all the time and effort you put into hunting and then mm-hmm. filling those tags, and like I heard you on another podcast about it's the quantity of deer this year, and it's about all those does that maybe you can fill those tags this year and put in the freezer. Yep. And when you do that and you lose a freezer because of whatever or because the door gets left open, I mean, it is yep. literally a gut wrencher.
Yeah, it sucks,
yeah.
man.
Yeah.
Especially when I go and open that door now and there's zero things in it. Right. Everything got thrown away
yep.
or handed out. And so last night we had, I had, man, 10 pounds of fish. Of like bluegill and walleye that we breaded up, deep fat fried, and we had a fish fry at my house, like a last minute little potluck fish fry at our house. And I used some of that ground. I took this is really it's really delicious. I took a bell pepper and I threw it in a pan, sauteed it up, and then I added my last packet of mule deer meat that I had that was in there. And my ground mule deer meat. And then I added 2 cans of pork and beans into that. And then like, I'd say like a half cup of brown sugar. And then you mix that up and then, dude, that shit's so good. And then we had that, we had the fish and then we had some like other side dishes, but, I didn't want to throw it away. So I'm just like, we're going to cook it right now. And so, and I had my wife. My wife got on the horn with some of our neighbors and set it up, and I called my mom and she came down, my mom and my stepdad came down, and we had a good old fashioned Midwestern fish fry, last night. And so it was fun, but it was like just a ton of work. I didn't want to do it, but now this week I have a refrigerator full of bratwursts. You know, a couple packs of bratwurst and some deer sauce, deer link sausage, and ground deer meat that we just gonna cook up. I gotta cook up and maybe refreeze the stuff after I cook it. So, not ideal of what I wanted to do, but I guess shit happens, right?
Yeah, it does. And I mean, I guess you're making the best of it with what happened. But so going back to your story with a couple of the things here. So your landscape project. So obviously owning a landscape business, I'm starting to see a lot of this myself. You said you went from mulch to rock.
Yep.
And your thing was because your mulch is going out in your yard. And it does it. How much does it have to do with the fact that it's a maintenance thing every year, every other year that you're mulching your house versus like once you put the rock down, it's pretty much always stay there.
Yeah. The rock is permanent. It doesn't blow around in the wind. Animals don't typically dig up in it. I don't know. It is maintenance for me. It's funny because the lady's like, when we're talking about what plants to put into the flower bed, I was like, I want plants that I don't have to do shit with.
Right.
I want to plant them. I want them to look beautiful and that's it. And she's like, oh, okay. And then of course it's north facing. So it's in the shade most of the day. And like in the mornings, it gets sun, and then the late afternoon it gets sun, but the rest of the day it's in the shade. So we had to go through and find the perfect plants for that. But I don't want to do shit.
Yeah. No, I see it all the time. And I think a lot of it, I mean, just like on my end, I think a lot of it isn't necessarily that everybody's getting lazier. Let's say it's the fact that they just don't have time. I mean, with kids and sports and everything. And then the fact of the matter too is, like if you're putting rock down, I mean, there is more expense in that rock right now, but longevity wise, you're not going to be paying for it every year with the mulch. So, you know, I've had to adjust to that, but I'm seeing a lot of rock jobs this year, probably more so than ever. And that's not a bad thing. But one other thing I wanted to touch on with you is this contractor situation. Like, so obviously we're having to put an addition on the house and, you know, we got numbers back for what we want, right? And like what we feel like will work for all of us. So did you hire all of it out, or did you do any of it yourself, like the siding and stuff like that?
Well, so the siding was an insurance job.
Oh, okay.
So it was hail damage. So we got that, you know, of course we got to pay our deductible or whatever that is.
Right.
But yes, there's that. And then on top of that, my neighbor across the road, he's a construction guy. And so him and a crew put our new windows in. Now, I told him to charge me full price, but I don't think he did charge me full price. I think he gave me like the friend's discount, which I was like, man, this check just doesn't, the check that I'm writing him doesn't seem like the work that I actually did.
Yeah.
The work that he actually did. So I said, dude, I don't want a discount because these guys got to eat too, you know? So
right.
I was just like, dude, let's just charge me what you would normally charge somebody. I have no problem because I know their family. They're like family to us. And so I was like, just charge me what you would charge me, dude. I'll pay for it. I don't care. I feel like he gave me a discount. But anyway, so I hired that out. I don't know shit about that. I actually worked for a landscaping company for a handful of summers. And so I knew how to do the retaining wall. I knew how to do the weed bed and planting and watering and all that stuff's fairly simple. Now I just have to chainsaw out a whole bunch of stumps and do a grinder or like a stump grinder next to my siding. So I got to figure out how I'm going to do that. So outside of that, dude, it's just, if I know how to do it and I feel comfortable doing it, I'll do it. But if it comes to like electricity, I don't fuck with electricity.
Yeah.
I don't mess with plumbing, except like replacing a toilet. I suck at drywall. Like, here's a whole list of things that I just don't mess with.
Yeah. See, that's okay. So that's kind of where I'm going with this is pretty much everything my entire life I've just figured out or just done or a dad or brother or somebody helped me in that situation. Well, now it's just like, for one, I don't have the time, and two, the project's just too big beyond me.
Yeah.
And I'm sitting here looking at it like, got a referral for a guy. It's a great drawing. He does great work and everything, but we're sitting here like jaw dropping numbers and I'm wondering, you know, and I'm just wondering, like, how many bids do we get on this thing before we actually say, yeah, you know, because then there's another part of it. It's like, time-wise, like, we want to get this thing done, and I don't know. It's just, we've broke it down in several different ways, and it's just like, man.
Life is not cheap, dude. What happened? I just feel what happened. Like, I grew up on a farm. Like, my grandparents never went out to eat. Me and my family, we really never went out to eat. We never had fancy things. Baseball was like 8 weeks a year. Now it's like 8 months a year. Like everything is just bigger and more. And like, I don't know, dude, there's part of me, this is like, we're way off topic now, but, but like, there's part of me that's just like the good old days, man. Like what's wrong with driving a vehicle until it shits the bed? What's wrong with like not having the best cabinets in your house? What's wrong with, you know, like just going to Walmart and buying your clothes? Like, I don't understand that shit. Like what?
Right.
And it literally is because people judge other people and other people don't want to be judged. So they buy shit to make themselves look better than what they really are. And like, we could transfer that over into the hunting community. I got to have this certain type of camo. I got to have a certain type of bow. It don't mean shit. None of it means shit, dude.
No, so. it's the same as what we talk about all the time about buying that latest and greatest bow, or, you know, the trend is I don't want to bash a tree stand or a saddle or this or that, you know, but that's exactly what it is. One guy brings it up and then he brings it to his platform, and then pretty soon you have a bunch of following, and then everybody's doing it. And if you're not doing it, you're not following the cool way or the only way to kill a deer, you know, and it's just crazy.
Yeah. All right. So we got a hard pivot. We got to stop.
There you go.
We got to stop all this BS. We got to get into the topic today. Last week we talked bedding areas.
Yep.
Right. Oh, hey, wait, we got to do a commercial for our partner.
Oh yeah.
Right. So we got to do a huge shout out to our partner at Code Blue Sense. Right. You have a package coming in the mail at some point.
Oh, thank you.
I turned in your order and they're going to ship you basically what you wanted. I got a order in the mail, man. What, last week, full of my, the stuff that I really like. They know that I use the laundry detergents. I use the Rope-A-Dope mock scrape kit. I am going to use this year. I don't have a lot of it, but the Scrape Mate, the Gravedigger Scrape Mate, where you sprinkle that on top. I'm just going to see, I'm going to mess around with it. I've never really used any, urines or real or synthetic deer urines before, but I'm going to mess around with that this year. So, Code Blue Sense has a variety of real and synthetic deer urines. They have other attractants. They have laundry detergent, other scent elimination products. They have the Rope-A-Dope mock scrape kit with the rack rub, preorbital gel. So go to codebluesense.com, enter the discount code NFC at checkout. Get it right now. The one thing that I'm going to suggest is buying the two-pack. Rope-A-Dope mock scrape kit 2-pack. It's a better value, and codebluesense.com, discount code NFC20. All right, cool. So we talked about bedding areas last week. This week, let's go down the line. Let's talk about transition areas, right?
Okay.
So that path that they take. So here's what I'm envisioning: bedding, transition, staging, destination food.
Okay.
Now, yep. That means something in different places. I just had a good conversation with my buddy on the Nine Finger Chronicles podcast, Jeremy Dinsmore, about what bed to food pattern looks like to him. He's a big woods hunter. He hunts the alpine type of or the Appalachian type of mountains out in eastern PA. And sometimes he hunts Ohio. So that's like a little bit bigger terrain out there. So that looks different. For me and you, we're looking at a little bit more of that farm, you know, that farm country, type environment. Maybe some swamp, some marsh that I've hunted in the past, maybe some bigger open, like Nebraska type whitetail. I've hunted that. South Dakota. We've hunted South Dakota whitetails too. So that looks a little bit different. And what I'll say here, this is a good starting point. If we're going to talk about a transition piece, that transition can be 100 yards or that transition could be 3 miles, depending right. on what your scenario is. As we know, out west, that transition from bedding to food is going to be, could be way bigger than Midwest farm country, or even like big timber where all that stuff is, could potentially be closer.
Yeah.
So when I say transition, tell me what you think when I say the word transition to you in, as far as a deer's daily routine.
First off, I think a transition is you're coming out of a comfort zone first, you know? So, I mean, there's a sense of like automatic alertness, if that makes sense, you know, yep. They're going to get up out of their bed and their first thing they're going to do is look, smell and hear, you know, in every direction that they can. And so that transition then becomes, where can I go that I feel the safest for that day? Because I mean, each day could be different with the wind, the temperature. If a farmer's in a field or if they've been pressured that day, if the predators are high in that area. So to me, a transition just is simply based off of many factors. So we could sit and say it's a terrain transition. It's a predator transition. I mean, we could break it down multiple ways because I don't think a deer just has one transition area.
Oh, no. Again, you know, like, so we went on this tangent last week about wind direction, right?
Right.
Like wind direction means something different. Like it means the deer are going to bed in different spots. Well, that same wind direction thermal theory applies to transition and how they're going to walk through the landscape to a staging area or a food source. So right. I would say that this has less to do with vegetation, and this is just me. Obviously, vegetation and cover plays a role, but my gut is telling me, and based off of what I've seen, is that terrain now has the biggest impact in how deer move through areas. And I'll use the Midwest farm country where they're staying low, or they're not skylining themselves, and they will work their way on that military crest you hear people talk about. And it's the same thing out west where you have more wide open. They're taking advantage of the low spots so that they don't skyline themselves. They know exactly what they're doing. How many times have we walked out in Nebraska and South Dakota and we've turned around thinking there's nothing there, and then we see like a whole bunch of does just staring right back at us.
Right.
So they're very good at hiding themselves just by walking through the right spots of terrain because they've done it for so long. So my gut tells me that it's more terrain focused and less vegetation.
Yeah. Yeah, I can agree with that, because I mean, I feel like, you know, they're going to walk through. Well, it's the same as, you know, this in Iowa where there's fields are broke up by the terraces and stuff. You know, those deer will use those terraces to their advantage just because of the elevation change in the field, you know. Yep. So it's not necessarily we need a bunch of trees or, you know, I like that. I like the terrain.
Yep. Yeah. Okay. So. Let's just start with the obvious. Let's start with the east side of the you know, east of the Mississippi River, or, well, let's start farm country, East Coast hunting. What specific terrain are you looking for that would coincide with a transition to a staging or food? What are you looking for?
I think the big thing for me when I'm looking for a transition is do I see... I like to either hunt forward or backward. So meaning where do I anticipate them bedding, or where do I anticipate them to feed, and find that spot in between that actually looks like something from a road perspective. I can't see it. You know, if I can pull it up on a map and I could see that there's a dip in this hill or whatever, and they can, you know, skirt around it halfway at the bottom or whatever, even if it's got vegetation, even if it's got trees or nothing at all, and then find something in between that, you know, if there's a staging area, you know, an open area that's covered by trees, and you can see pockets of, maybe it's early season and it's warm and there's a water source in that area, that could be part of a transition area, and it could also lead to that staging area. I also think there's a transition between some staging to destination food as well. And then, like you said, to start this, you know, we do realize that these deer don't always have to go 3 miles to their destination. Some deer only have to go 50 yards. Some deer turn around out of their bed, they're in the staging area, and then they're boop, boop, right into the destination food. So,
Yep. All right. So I'm going to be more specific here, and I'm going to tell you two that I really look for. All right. So a ridge coming out of a bottom that, and really you can flip this. Maybe it's thick bedding on top and then a river bottom. I'm envisioning a river bottom down in that has all the ag down in the river bottom. I'm for some reason I'm thinking about Wisconsin when I'm saying this, where they're bedding up high and so they can get a good view of everything down below, and they're taking a ridge system down into an ag field of some sort.
Okay, so your food's on the bottom, your bedding's up top.
My food on this scenario, my food is on the bottom, bedding's on top. Maybe a bigger wood, thicker, nastier wood. If you get up into northeast Iowa, southwest Wisconsin, all along like the Mississippi River Valley, you're going to see a lot of this. They're coming down to where everything is farmed, and that's usually the low spots, the river bottoms. And they're going to be working that ridge. So I'm envisioning a ridge, a big ridge that comes out of the bottom and is going, bedding is on the west and ag is on the east. And I'm just using this for the most simple, simple explanation here. If the wind's coming out of the south, they will be traveling on the north face of that ridge.
Right.
If the wind is out of the north, they're going to travel on the south of that south face of that ridge. Does that make sense to you?
Yep.
Okay. And the reason they do that is, number one, so they're not skyline. Number one, so they can see everything below them and smell anything coming up over top of them. Right. Okay. And then you use your own judgment here of what, you know, how that works as far as if the ridge instead runs west to east, it runs from north to south, right? If it runs north to south and you have a west wind, they're going to be traveling on the east face. If they have an east wind, they're going to be traveling on the west face, right?
Right.
And so they do that because that's how deer move, right?
Mm-hmm.
Now, the opposite, well, farm country then is a little bit different. It's still the same principle of how they travel through this wind, using the wind. But typically what happens is now, instead of the ridge being that, you just flip the terrain, and now the timbered finger coming up into the ag field. So the deer are more than likely bedding off of a ridge that goes in, but they're working a draw, a timbered finger, right, coming up into the field, usually entering in a low spot where, you know, all this wind will pool down in and make basically a funnel of wind and scent for them that they can come in and scent check large areas before they pop out. But for example, on a timbered finger that's running north into a big ag field, okay, on an east wind, they're going to be traveling on the west facing side. Again, on a west wind, they're going to be traveling on the east side of that, right? And so the timbered finger is the low point, and they're going to be traveling, and that's usually where you find the sign.
One
thing that I've always noticed is there's always a couple rubs right on that a field edge, and then there's also a couple, there's always usually scrapes on whatever side they work their way up. And then depending on how big that finger is, if you're able to get in there, there's a trail, like depending on how wide this timbered finger is, if it's, let's say it's 100 yards wide and that finger kind of just dwindles away into nothing, well, there's going to be a trail in there to where they don't have to expose themselves until they get to the end of that finger, and they can pretty much go undetected into the low spot and scent check everything that's coming down in there, depending on wind direction, of course, and what thermals are doing. But then usually at the tip of that finger is that staging area. So where there's always like a rub, lots of scrapes and things like that. So, when I think of a transition, I think of big draws leading into ag, and I think of big ridge systems. And even I'll take it one step further in elaborating on ridges. I would say that ridges then would lead up to maybe an oak flat. Like when we're talking big timber here, I think there's a lot of food in the big timber, especially if there's a lot of oaks. So that transition will vary depending on wherever the oak trees are at. If there's oak trees all over, they're going to be all over. There's not like the straight line that I'm thinking of and that I grew up in river bottom ground. This time of year, you're going to find me jigging for crappies off my father-in-law's boat, celebrating a successful turkey hunt, or just sitting on the back deck watching time go by with a quality cigar from Thompson Cigar. Thompson Cigar has been around since 1915, offering the widest array of cigars and cigar accessories at very affordable prices. Thompson Cigar offers your favorite brands like Swisher Sweets, Cohiba, Backwoods, and Monte Cristo shipped fresh directly to your door. Also, be sure to check out their 5-pack fever deals and join their value club for big savings. Visit thompsoncigar.com and enter the discount code SE at checkout for 20% off of all orders over $75. Thompson Cigar, quality cigars at affordable prices. Bow hunters are some of the hardest working hunters there are. Most of us work hard all year long just to get a couple weekends or burn our vacation time to sit in a tree. And just like the American blue-collar worker, we're trying to balance work, family, faith, and a little time for ourselves in the great outdoors. Now let me introduce you to Trollco Clothing, a brand built by blue-collar workers for blue-collar workers. Workwear, comfortable tees, hoodies and hats for both men and women, Trollco represents the hardworking American. So whether you're operating heavy equipment, wrenching on engines, or in a factory living that shift life, Trollco has your back, literally. Head to trollco.com/hunting. That's trollco.com/hunting and enter the discount code Empire25 for 25% off of your first order. Trollco, for the hardworking American.
When it, or ag country, where it's just straight line, or I don't want to say straight line, but like it's always bed, then it's some sort of transition, then staging, then destination, and then they flip that and they come back and they do the same thing on the back depending on the wind direction.
The world moves fast. Your workday, even faster. Pitching products, drafting reports, analyzing data. Microsoft 365 Copilot is your AI assistant for work. Built into Word, Excel, PowerPoint, and other Microsoft 365 apps you use. Helping you quickly write, analyze, create, and summarize. So you can cut through clutter and clear a path to your best work. Learn more at Microsoft.com/M365 Copilot.
So yeah, so I took off. I probably didn't explain my part as good as I should have. So I'm just going to use my hand or anybody's hand as an example. So if the top of your hand or the pad of your hand is like the oak flat, just say, as Dan described it, we were, you know, up top, the deer were up top and they were going down to destination food. And then each one of your fingers is a finger, a draw. Deer will use those in any given direction, wind direction and stuff, and it keeps them tucked away. So if this is my first time of ever scouting a piece of property or looking at a map, those are definite signs that I look for. You know, is there fingers coming to and from? And that's part of that transition. So for me, that kind of simplifies it when I go out of state on an out-of-state hunt. One of the first pieces I ever looked at on a map, I'm like, well, I remember years and years ago when I'd hunted in Montana, a rancher had told me that the mule deer love to bed in coulees, they call them. Well, a coulee is a big dished out, you know, draw, basically. They just call them different names. And they also use those for travel. Well, fast forward, and as you start to use those draws and realize that deer like those areas, now I've started to put other things together where, so we can reverse engineer this and we have the food at the top or the food at the bottom. That part didn't matter. But what I started to realize with these fingers was if they're laying in a certain direction and deer, does just say, use these up and down, bucks during the rut will actually travel over top of those because their first thing is, I want a doe. And so if the wind is in their favor, they will travel over those. And so you look for those narrow tracks and trails through the woods, because the beat down trails, and for guys that maybe that don't know this, the beat down trails generally are not a buck trail from what my experience is. That's generally a routine pattern for does.
Yeah. And I mean, all deer use them.
Yeah.
But this is where, for me, it becomes, this is where I found a lot of success, especially during the time of year where deer are on their feet more, like that October, November timeframe, where, you know, during the breeding season. I feel like aside from staging areas, my number two, I very rarely kill deer in bedding areas, and I very rarely kill deer in destination food. So I would say my number one spot, my favorite spot, which we'll talk about next week, is staging, but transition is my second, where I've killed the most deer. Second would be transition. And so the reason though that I like transitions from a strategy standpoint is because I feel
staging areas, or not, excuse me, not staging areas, transitions have the easiest access routes to get to the tree stands. And you're knowing that the deer are not there, right? Imagine a compass. Maybe I can do it this way. Imagine a compass, and you draw it out north, and then you draw a line down to south, and then you got west, and then you draw a line to east. Okay. Let's say, yep, there you go. Let's say a deer is moving from east to west. Okay. And there's a make-believe trail there. You found it. There's some terrain feature that dictates, you know, like high ground is north, low ground is south, and you found a trail in between there somewhere. Maybe it's a ridge. Maybe it's a edge of a swamp or something like that. And then you also have a north wind. Well, the best part about this is there's two ways to look at it. You can start low and go high, or and start walking up, and you can be on the south side of that. This is where, dude, this is where starts to get complicated for me.
Yeah.
Or for some people, I think, because we take it to the next level a lot. Okay. I'm going to try to do this as easy as I can, as simply as I can. The deer are moving in this scenario from east to west. High ground is north, low ground is south. We have a north wind, and if it's a north wind and it is an afternoon hunt, that means thermals will be rising. Okay. So for me, I am okay with hunting with accessing from the north, having my wind blow across the trail until I get to my stand location. And then I get up in the tree. I have the wind going south, and the trail would also then be south of me. Uh-huh. And my thermals, however, are popping up, or going up. Now, the risk here is that when the sun starts to go down, thermals start pulling down, and then there's a risk there. So I actually do the same thing in the morning hunts too, where the thermals are pulling down. The wind would be also going down. I get in the tree stand from the north, and then I can set up. And then as the sun comes up, thermals come up. Wind is now pushing my thermals over. And I have seen it where deer will travel in front of me all day without getting busted until the potential heavy clouds in the sky, and then thermals will shift, or the sun goes down in the end of the day and shift. Now I have to explain the flip side of this. Let's say we have the exact same scenario here, but now we have a property line to the north, and we can't access that access route anymore. And maybe there is a way, but you got to J-hook into it. So I would then just flip it. And see, for me, I have no problem crossing that hypothetical trail that's in this spot, because I'm not I believe in scent control, but I feel like if there's so much time that usually goes by from the time that the deer get into the woods and start making their way back to bed, that my scent would not be, they may notice it, but it's not like a huge issue. I use nose jammer. So right. I feel like that does something to my boots. And when I walk through, and it's not like I'm laying down and rolling around in the grass there, I'm just quickly walking through to my stand, get up, and I'm good. So flip it. No access from the north. Now I'm in the bottom and I'm walking uphill to my stand location. Now, if I know I'm only going to be hunting this stand location on a north wind and my access is only from the south, well, at this point, then I have my stand location south of the main trail. Okay. Right. And that way I never have to cross the trail at this point. And I'm hunting it on a north wind in the mornings. Thermals are rising. Right. And so I'm really secure. These are the type of hunts where you feel invisible at times because your thermals are working overtime. The wind direction coincides with that. There's no swirling winds and you're just feeling great, right? That, right. Those are the best. So that's an example of kind of like, that's very high level, how I try to choose my stand locations on a scenario like that. Hopefully that wasn't too terribly complicated.
No, I don't think so. It's, I will say there is a learning curve with finding those exact locations with what you can get away with as far as your thermals versus the wind. But there's also those terrain features. Because as we're sitting here talking, I'm thinking about all these transition areas and how they really are dictated by a terrain feature in itself. And then I started to think, like, your favorite topic is staging area. And then I started to break it down in all these hunting areas that I've been before and like, whoa, wait a second. You know, there's this transition that leads to a staging area, but they're coming off of bed. And then I start to play it all in my head. Like, how many of my stands have literally been described as what you're saying off of a terrain feature?
Right.
So
the other thing, when it comes to the access routes that we try to use to get into this transition type hunting style, is you kind of got to know, and this is where you have to really focus on not being lazy, because, man, I try to avoid going through a bedding area on the way in or the way out. Obviously, if I'm going in and I'm going to stomp through a bedding area, that's just dumb, right? You don't want to do that. Or on your way out of the property, you're walking through a staging area or a destination food source. Also, not the greatest thing to do. So I always try to find an access route where I'm, like, the term deer desert has been used in the past by certain people where there's just not a lot of deer movement. They don't come through those areas. And those are the areas that I want to come through to get to my access route, or my use my access route to my transition hunting location. The cool thing about transitions is I like them because usually it is a deer are coming through and they're not stopping. Very often. Maybe there's a rub or a scrape somewhere that you might pull up and hunt, but they show up, they walk through, they stop, and then they come back. And then they do the reverse in the morning. And so it's not an area where you have to be too careful. Like, there are some spots that I have that are transition spots where I'm going to go in an hour or two before I feel that the deer are going to get up out of their bed and walk to the destination food. So I am literally going to be there and only have maybe see deer for 10 minutes. That's it. They're going to walk by me and then they're going to disappear. And that's all I want, really. That's all I want. I'm not sitting here, like, we've talked about this a long time ago. I'm not here to see deer. I'm here to hunt deer.
Right.
And so that has what has kind of led me over the years, driving me into cover as opposed to sitting on a field edge and just walk. Oh, I saw 30 deer today. None of them were in shooting range. And so, again, finding the access route where you're going to intercept deer coming and then coming, like, and then going and then coming back into their bedrooms. And then that way, man, you're not bumping deer at all. And if you have the right access route, you can hunt those locations over and over and over and over again. If you're not loud, if you're really good and you're smart with your wind and thermals, those deer won't even know you're there. And then you can hunt that. And then it's like, if you're trying to be buck specific, you can find that doe group and you can be like, all right, here we go. Here comes these doe groups. And at some point, a buck's going to be behind him.
Well, and I think that's where, like, I'm looking at it now is, you know, I can sit there, I can walk in the woods and I can identify that terrain feature. I can identify that staging area. And so don't be lazy about it. You know, get out there, put some work in, get that woodsmanship, put it to use. And then once you get home, you can actually start pulling it up on a map and you can start looking at other pieces of property and you will correlate those and they will all make sense to you. So the one thing that I was taking away from, like, this whole sitting for 2-3 hours only to see deer for 10 minutes. I think, and I mean, maybe your friend Jeremy, you know, could describe it better, because anybody that hunts out east or in the big woods scenario, to me, when you're in a big woods scenario, I almost feel like you have a better chance of deer just walking by. Yeah. You know, instead of, I'm going to go in for an afternoon hunt, I'm going to sit there for 2-3 hours, and then the last 10 to 30 minutes is when I anticipate seeing deer. Versus, and I think that's literally just because, like, in here in the Midwest, if you're hunting, you know, fence rows, or if you're hunting, you know, creek bottoms or something like that, or ag ground, that's basically what you're getting. You're getting deer going from bed to food, and that's where setting up in those transition areas and accessing those transition areas is going to be, you know, in your favor.
100%. All right. So long draws, right? Any type of draw leading into ag, any type of big ridge system. And usually there's a trail that coincides. Like, if you are a very beginner and you're listening to this and you may be overwhelmed at this point, here is the simplest description that I can have for you. And that would be to walk in the woods and find a trail, right? And stand directly on that trail and look one direction and see where it goes, and then look another direction and see where it goes, and then look to find the skyline point, the peak of that ridge, and then find out what direction that is. And that's the direction that you need the wind to come from. So perpendicular, that's like when it crosses, right?
Yep.
Parallels when it runs, right? So yep. Usually a trail will run parallel with a ridge. Okay. So you want to find a wind direction that is perpendicular to that trail. This is the most basic thing that I can say. And so you find the high point, and then you say, I need wind to come from that. And then you put your tree stand on the downwind side of that trail. And so you have, let's say, I'm just going to use the north and south, for example. Ridge runs north-south from low to high. Put your, there's going to be a trail that runs north-south as well. Uh-huh. And if you have a west wind, you're going to need to set your stand on the east side of the trail on the east-facing slope. Now, all you have to do is flip that, the east-facing slope. All you have to do is flip that for an east wind.
Right.
Because the deer are going to travel on the other side of that ridge. And to me, that is like the most basic. And then once you figure that out and it connects for you, then you can take that exact principle for all these different awkward type scenarios.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. All these different awkward places. So.
Well, and I think those transitions, there's always, you know, an intersection that can be used as well too. Mm-hmm. And like we initially said from the beginning of this is, these transition areas, they're not necessarily always used every single day the same exact way. You know, if there is a different wind, or if they've been pressured or whatever, you know, deer have an escape plan every time.
They do.
You know, they're either going to come up out of the draw, they're going to go down out of the draw if they're in a draw and they're being pressured or pushed or something. When they're in open ground, you know, they're using that terrain feature to hide them as they're walking. They're not going to skyline. Their last resort is skyline and run. You know, so I think just kind of backtracking from destination to bed, or bed to destination, and then finding that area in between. And then once you find that area in between, once you're driving around at night, so here's an example. We took a side-by-side ride the other night, and I wanted to show the kids all these deer out in these bean fields and stuff. And boy, we saw a lot of deer, and it was a fun trip.
Yeah.
And, you know, so for me, like, I see these deer on a regular basis. I know what fields they're going to be in. I know crop rotation and stuff. So now I know their destination food source. So then I start to go backwards with it. And then in the mornings, you can see the flip side of it sometimes. You can actually catch them at a tree line as they're starting to go back to bed. So I think once you put a little time in and put that woodsmanship in, and then start to identify those terrain features and start to dabble with, you know, because I think the first thing before you get high level with it, just dabble with the wind and what directions you can get away with, then start to dabble with the thermals and stuff and what your thermals do and what you can get away with and not get away with.
Absolutely.
Because as we've talked before, if you're hunting in and around a water source, water does different things with your thermals and the wind.
Yeah. Yep. And sometimes depending on the size of the body of we're just complicated. We're just making this. We're so stupid. We are complicating everything for these people. But it's true. Like I was down. In our town, we have golf carts. We're allowed to use golf carts. And so we went down this big hill, and at the bottom is this creek, and it's in the shade. And the wind, I just noticed it because I'm stupid. All the deer last night were out on the, is it like a west wind, a southwest wind, and all the deer were on the east facing slopes in the bean fields and stuff. And so I could feel like this breeze on the west, on, you know, whatever side of my face was facing west. I get down to the bottom, and that creek runs, what direction does that creek run? It runs east to west, right? So I get down there, and the breeze isn't, it's not a strong breeze, but I get down to the bottom, I'm on this bridge, and I can feel the wind has shifted because the body of water is moving east. The thermals are getting pulled in with that in the shade, and now it's hitting the opposite side of my face.
And
I'm like,
that's also 10 degrees cooler than where you just were, isn't it?
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. I almost was like, man, I almost need a long sleeve shirt here.
Right.
And it was, so it's noticeable. Once you can start to pick up on these types of things, then you're going to be able to realize, like, oh my God, like it's going to start to click for you. All right. Now, man, everybody talks about rubs and scrapes. Of all this bedding, transition, staging, destination food, my opinion is that you are going to find less sign in transition areas than you will any of the other places.
100%.
So this is where I've always been hesitant listening to people. Like especially when they say, hey, you need to go scouting and look for sign. Man, I don't necessarily agree with that. I feel like sign is awesome, right? Don't get me wrong. Sign is awesome. But if you're hunting a transition area, and maybe the transition area is all you have access to, and you have a good access route, man, I don't care if there's not any sign. I'm looking for terrain features. And if there might be some rubs and some scrapes in there, which would be a great indicator of where you need to be. But if there's not, I'm not letting that be the factor of why I'm not hunting that specific spot.
I can almost use it like we talked about it last week. You know, I go in and I identify an area that has, you know, 20 to 50 rubs in it, micro rubs. And it's a buck bed, you know, and I'm going to actually stay out of it. That's how I see it. One thing that I do like to do is when I see a fresh scrape pop up, I like to monitor it with a camera and see if it's being used regularly, because they will make, you know, along field edges and stuff, they will make periodic scrapes. But the thing of it is, deer will rub and deer will scrape on their way back and forth 100 different times in 100 different directions. It's not always going to be, you know, it depends on what type of hunter you want to be. Do you want to be a bedroom hunter? Do you want to be a transition hunter? Do you want to be a destination food source hunter? And that's where you sink your time in. For me, I've had awesome luck with these properties where there has been zero sign, you know? Yep. So what's that tell you? You know, I'm hunting a transition area.
Yep. Yep. Man, it is, We are making it sound very complicated, but it is really not. Wow. It's not. Transition areas, in my opinion, are the easiest places to hunt. They're areas where you could also, I'm thinking of a big valley that I hunt, and it has, the valley runs east-west, but there's all these ridges coming off from the north to the south, and then on the opposite side of the valley from the south to the north. And some of these ridges, you can set up on them and you can see the opposite side of the ridge when all the leaves fall off, and you can just watch how deer move through the terrain. Right? And so really, like, honestly, what it comes down to is just setting up somewhere in a transition to where the deer are walking by you, but also having the wherewithal to identify other opportunities in the woods and saying, well, dude, this could also be a great observation sit for me, and which is going to allow me to gather some information and move my tree stand 100 yards in that direction, 10 yards in this direction, or whatever the case is. And then it will allow me to, like just get closer to deer movement. Right. And then also like milkweed, dude,
yeah,
bring some milkweed into the woods with you. It's the oldest trick in the book. Drop milkweed, see what that milkweed does. Drop, they make synthetic stuff that you can pull out and drop and just watch it float away and see what it does. And maybe a deer busts you. Oh my God. How'd this deer bust me? Drop that milkweed and watch it float with the thermals and the wind and just, oh my, okay. So it's looping back in somehow. Maybe I need to move my tree stand and, find the access route, things like that. So I don't know. Anything else that we need to talk about on transitions? I think I have a couple more things here, but I want to get your thoughts.
I don't know. I think the biggest thing for me on transitions is going back to what you were saying initially with the terrain features and the land features and how you can use those in your advantage to, as far as the height of them and mm-hmm. where deer are going to be in relevance into their trails and where they intersect and in relevance to their bedding and how close you can actually get to deer without actually being in their bedroom or being on the destination food source. And your access into that spot. What is your access look like? Because for me, you know, you were mentioning walking like through a destination food source and how that's obviously a big no-no is how you are accessing it. If you are able to come down into something, if you have a fence row, if you have a tree line, your access into these spots is probably just as important as your access out, but also your time on the stand.
Right. Yeah. Yeah, that, like, for me, like, if you go back to the beginning of me doing podcasting, I, as everybody knows, my big thing is access routes. Like, when I started taking the correct access routes in and not being a straight line guy, man, I was seeing more deer almost instantly. And I did that through following terrain features, maybe trying to stay low, use dried creek beds or even water ways to try to get there, hide myself as much as possible, know where my wind is going as I'm walking into these stand locations, and then know what my wind is doing, because that is equally as important as what your wind is doing while you're in the tree stand.
Right.
So that could be the difference between seeing, you know, going in and seeing a handful of deer and that, or seeing a really big giant mature buck who shows up that you didn't know you busted,
right?
You know, 2 hours ago when you were walking into the tree stand with your wind blowing right into his bedding area. So it can be tough, dude. It can be tough.
Yep. What were your couple points that you wanted?
Transition, right? So,
yeah.
Here are a couple other little tidbits that when I think of transition, I think of like fence crossings. These are easy to, you follow a trail and you find a fence crossing. I have a little area in mind where I have a fence crossing that it's actually overgrown timber that used to be in a cattle, like when it was way more cattle. Since then, there's a trail that runs up this draw and there's a fence crossing and you can see where they've crossed this fence, where they leave and they jump and then they walk, right? I found sheds in this fence crossing before. And so if you can find a fence crossing where you have access to both sides of the fence, I would set up right on that fence crossing.
Right.
On the other hand, if you find a fence crossing and that fence, you don't have permission to hunt that, I would hunt off that fence crossing just a little bit, because that, I mean, it's just another indicator that deer are moving there. Right. And maybe you have access to the timber, and across the fence is the destination food, and you can't hunt that, but you have the bedding on your side. You hunt that little fence crossing, or you flip it and you have the other, you have the destination food and the staging, and they have the bedding, and there's that fence crossing, man. A fence crossing to me is just an area where there's concentrated deer movement, right? Because they could cross this fence 1,000 different places, but they're choosing to cross it right here for some reason.
Right.
And so that tells me, holy shit, I should be right here.
Uh-huh. I think that's the biggest thing, is just being able to identify, you know, and a lot of times identifying is just going out into the woods and just putting in some time and scouting, and being able to decipher what trail is active, what trail is inactive, what terrain feature is actually going to be in my favor, what terrain feature is in the deer's favor, you know? Mm-hmm. And I don't know, like I said, I sometimes now just kind of reverse engineer the whole thing to where I know where the food is and I know where they bed.
Right. And the other one is creek crossings. I mean, it's another very simple, very identifiable place. Sometimes a creek can be a border of a property as well. And so I'm just going to straight up just tell you guys, like, I have a creek crossing that I'm going to say 90% of the deer that transfer from one property over to the property that I can hunt use this one creek crossing. I'm not joking. They use it. And so I have set up years, and I have watched deer funnel across this for 18, or it's probably been 16 years since I found this crossing. And I have a tree stand within shooting distance of that. And so, dude, I sit there and I just watch deer funnel in front of me every time, like coming off destination food, back into bedding, and from bedding to destination food. And it just so has, like, I've only killed one buck in that area. It wasn't right on that crossing, but the day before he used it. And then that's when I moved a permanent stand closer to there. And since then I haven't killed a deer on it, but I've had every other deer come through there. And it's just a matter of time, dude. It's just a matter of time.
Well, I think with the fence line crossing or the creek crossing, anytime that a deer is having to cross something, that's when they become a little vulnerable too. So, I mean, they'd have to drop their guard, or they have to pick their head up or drop their head or whatever. That's when you can actually, you know, especially if you can hunt both sides of it, like you were saying, you know, if you can only hunt one side of it, you might as well back off of it a little bit, because there is that tease factor to where you see something and you can't get on that side. But yeah, setting up in and around those are great spots too. So
100%. Well, I think this is this was a great conversation. I do apologize. And I this is self-admittedly, right? This is the How to Hunt Deer podcast. And when you've been hunting as long as we have, sometimes I don't think we do a good enough job of, like, and this is with all due respect, of dumbing its stuff down, like of talking about the basics of this stuff. And so I tried to today, but like my mind kept switching over to the detailed part of it, because that's what I've been focusing on for all these years. So take what we say this upcoming season and go sit in the woods and just observe. And really, I think that's what it comes down to, is observe and just open your eyes and watch how deer move through terrain. And if you do that, that's gonna, and you're able to connect the dots in your own brain, man, that's going to be a huge deal for you guys. Like, I really do feel people are going to become more successful if they just observe a little bit more.
Yeah. I agree. And I think that's where observation stands come in pretty handy, especially if you're early on in your hunting. You know, if you can set it up at a fairly high level, elevation wise, without being skylined or without being picked apart, and get a good vantage of your property, I think you'll actually find success in that as well.
Yep. Absolutely. Absolutely. Okay, my friend, Jason, thanks for doing this today. To all the listeners out there, go check out CodeBlueSense.com. Also, go to Apple Podcasts, Spotify, wherever you download this podcast. Give us a 5-star review. Let everybody know that this was a very helpful episode, or this was a very helpful podcast for you. Good vibes, everybody, and we'll talk to you next week.
You're listening to the Sportsman's Empire Podcast Network, and this episode is brought to you by Interstate Batteries. For all of your battery needs, visit your local Interstate Batteries retail store. Interstate Batteries, outrageously dependable.